We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program. We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back here to the program once again Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. We do these shows, it's always on a Monday, and we do them so that you can have the chance to call in and ask questions about home maintenance issues. Can be just about anything that goes into the single-family home. Maybe you're noticing that the place isn't as warm and comfortable as you would like, and you're thinking about dealing with air leakage or insulation issues. We can also talk about lots of other things, about basements and furnaces and, well, air conditioning. Maybe you're not thinking about that now, but windows and siding and roofing, any and all that kind of thing. All you have to do is call us, and we'll see if we can help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. So that's the number to use if it would be a long-distance call. And you may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much.
Good morning, David. Thanks for having me.
Any particular kinds of questions you've been getting a lot of lately?
Well, I tell you what, we had the that nice long cold streak, and we had a lot of frost heave problems where concrete slabs were lifting. We had doorways that were difficult to open, mostly on a commercial building more than residential, because a residential door usually opens inward. But it also meant that a lot of the garage doors and stuff were starting to bind up. So it's one of those things, there's not much we can do about it. When we have a lot of good cold weather and the ground freezes, it does get a little bit of lift. So if you start seeing a little bit of movement, I'd have to say it's pretty much normal. So not to get too worried about a little bit of movement of the sidewalks and such.
Yeah, I was really – I guess I had this feeling that it's been colder than usual, and I was really surprised this morning on Morning Edition. Scott Altoff was talking about the fact that right now our average high is supposed to be 40. So it's definitely cold.
Definitely much colder than that.
All right. Well, we have a couple of callers to get to. We also have an email that we'll do, and we'll take as many people as we can this morning, starting, I think, with our line number one on the phones right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have kind of a more general question. We're going to be looking for a house, and not necessarily a new house. And one of the things we're concerned with is what are some of the more – is there like a list of things that we should definitely look for in a 5-year-old house versus a 10-year-old house versus a 25-year-old house? It's kind of – you know, when you're just walking through, something that we should be able to pick up before the inspection and before we get really involved in something like that?
There's actually no easy answer to that question. There's not a lot of difference in the newer homes, and I'll call newer anything newer than about 25 or 30 years.
Oh, that's even newer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, anything that was built, I would say, in the 80s and up. I mean, there's some inherent problems with different types of construction. As far as anything to look for, I would have to say that I would look for a lot that has good drainage. Champaign-Urbana is pretty notorious for having damp basements, damp crawl spaces. And so look for something where the house isn't the lowest one on the block. Make sure that there's enough slope away from the yard that you can provide a drainage pattern so that water runs away. And that's probably one of the things. As far as construction goes, our wood frame construction in this area is pretty durable. We've got houses that are over 120 years old in the area, and so we don't worry too much about the construction. It's not like some areas where we have stone or solid masonry is quite as prevalent.
Okay, so the one thing with the drainage, so don't they have to reveal if their basement's been flooded? Isn't that required or not?
Yes, it is. But first of all, you're assuming that the person in the house, it's flooded while that person was there. It may have flooded at a previous ownership, something like that.
Okay.
And not necessarily flooding is the problem. A constant dampness is more of an issue than a one- or two-time flooding. We can get water in a basement, I've seen it in scary proportions of up to almost 4 feet or 6 feet. But I mean, that is a one-time occurrence, and that really doesn't affect the house much because it's of the masonry foundations. But a basement that has a damp corner or a damp area or even a crawl space that has a little bit of water on the plastic, over long term, that can create a lot more problems than the one or two floodings.
Okay, so the obvious piece will be like if there's any dew or moisture or anything like that on the walls or the masonry, as you mentioned, or is there anything like would there be staining or something like that that would be fairly obvious or not?
One of my quick and easy ones that's pretty easy is kind of take a look in the attic. If you've got a pull-down stair or a hatch that you can move, if you look at the bottom of the roof sheathing, generally if the house has had a lot of moisture problems, there's some darkening or some mildew on the bottom of the roof sheathing. And that's an indication that at some point in time the house has had a high humidity problem.
Okay, so not even looking in the basement, look in the attic instead.
Because that's where it's going to show that the moisture starts collecting. Unfortunately, once you get some darkness on that roof sheathing, it doesn't go away. So if somebody has corrected the moisture problems, it could still leave the dark sheathing up in the attic. So it's not one of those things where it tells you immediately. What it is an indication that there are other things that we should be looking for.
Okay.
And generally a nice clean attic usually results with a nice clean crawl space.
Okay. All right. Well, that's helpful. Great. Okay. Thanks so much.
All right. Very good. Thank you. We'll go on. And the next person I think here is in line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We have a fireplace that we do not burn wood in anymore, and we're considering an electric insert for that. Can you give me some guidance on what we should consider and be looking for?
Actually, the electric inserts are pretty simple. There's really not much of anything that needs to be done. I would recommend, if you're going to put one in, to put some type of insulation or seal in the flue so that we don't have a lot of cold air going up there. There's really, other than the fact that they don't do much other than look good, the electric fireplaces are a nice little bit of ambiance. Some of them have a little bit of heater in there, basically like a little hairdryer, a little 1,500 watt or 2,000 watt heater, so you can turn on a fan and it blows a little bit of hot air back at you. I'd just make sure that the flue has got enough insulation that we're not running cold air up and out through the flue pipe. I'd make it something removable, so if you later on sell the house, somebody can pull it out and go back to wood burning. But no, don't have any recommendations that you would need to do anything with the electric because they're just so simple and easy to install.
So it's not a good idea to consider that as a supplemental heat for the room at all?
Electric heat in this area is, generally speaking, more expensive than gas heat. So if you've got a standard gas furnace, gas boiler, chances are, unless you're just using it to take a chill off, it would be more expensive to use the heat source to keep that room warmer than the rest of the house. So you'd probably be better off turning the thermostat up a degree or two than using an electric heat source.
Or what about going to a gas insert then?
Gas insert is usable, and it's a good, viable way of producing heat. First of all, fireplaces are never what I'll call a high-efficiency unit. Because of the flue pipe where we have to vent the heat up and out through the chimney, the efficiency rating on them is nowhere near the 80% or 85% that we can get on a furnace. A wood fireplace is probably, give or take, 10%, right about zero. If you burn the wood for 6 to 8 hours and you have to leave the damper open for 6 to 8 hours to let the embers cool down, chances are any heat you produced went on up the chimney. Gas is a little bit more efficient in that as soon as you turn the gas log off, you can close the chimney so you don't have any cold air loss going up through the chimney. But on an older home, you have to make sure that the chimney is in good condition. You start burning gas in there and getting a little bit of condensation in the flue, we can actually get some moisture problems in the chimney. So you want to make sure that the chimney gets checked and possibly get a liner in the chimney to make sure that the gas does not have any ill effects on the mortar inside the flue itself.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let me get in an email question here from somebody who is listening in. And we have someone here who says that he has some ungrounded two-prong outlets, electrical outlets, that he'd like to change to three-prong outlets. However, he says, to avoid running the grounded wires to the outlet, which you would have to do if you're going to do it that way, can it be done by using an ungrounded GFCI outlet, and what would be the disadvantages of doing that?
All right. Two-prong outlets are generally older homes that don't have a ground wire run. There is no requirement that an electrical system be updated to a grounded outlet. The only way to properly ground one, if you put in a third prong, the only way to properly ground it is to run a separate ground wire either to a water line or back to the service panel to the ground bus. There is no way about it. You can put in a three-prong outlet, and it doesn't necessarily have to be grounded. It's amazing how many people worry about these grounded outlets when they only have probably four or five appliances in the entire house that actually have a ground plug, unless we're using a high current draw items, a microwave, a refrigerator, power tools. Surge protector for a computer is probably the most common and most important one. But really, you don't necessarily need to ground all the outlets, because if you stop and think, okay, the living room, all the lights are two-prong, your bedroom, your clocks and lamps and such are all two-prong. But there is no way to add a ground to a outlet that's ungrounded unless you run another wire, like say, either to a cold water line or to a, which of course would assume that we have a metal water line, since the new ones nowadays are going in plastic. Or back to the main service panel and to the ground bus in that service panel.
Okay, so there's really no shortcut on this.
No, you can put in a ground fault circuit interrupter. You've got an older outlet in a bathroom with a two-prong. You can put in a ground fault circuit interrupter, and the ground fault circuit interrupter will operate, but it does not provide a true ground. But it does provide you with the GFCI protection, the ground fault circuit interrupter.
All right. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do the program once a month, and we take your questions on home maintenance. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up, we'll go over to our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm in Terre Haute, yes, and in this weather, we sort of think about getting a humidifier in our house, and I'm thinking of doing that. And the question I have is, how would you recommend regulating that? The vendors have two kinds of regulation. One is just measuring the relative humidity in the house. Another includes measuring the relative humidity outside and then regulating the humidifier according to that. I'd like to hear your recommendations on those regulation methods.
Okay, well, actually, they're both more or less one and the same. When we're regulating the relative humidity in the house, it's relative to the humidity outdoors. So if we have a very cold day where we have a, let's say, a humidity level of 8% or 10%, assuming it's around zero, to have the house at 20%, it means that we're relatively humid because we're double the amount of humidity outdoors. But then again, on a 30-degree day when we have probably 40% humidity, you would have to have the house at, say, 55 or 60% just to be 50% more moisture in the house than outside. So it does have a direct correlation to the outdoor temperature. First of all, let me say that if you're looking at putting in a power humidifier, it probably means you need to go around and seal the house up a little bit, because it means that the moisture that's in the house from cooking, cleaning, showering, things like that is leaving. So you probably have some weather stripping, insulation, or air leakage problems. That being said, if you do still need the power humidifier, the best, I would say, gauge to use as to, for moisture is if you wake up in the morning and you have some moisture condensation on the windows or even a little bit at the bottom of the window, then you've got the humidity level a little bit too high. If you walk across the carpet and reach for a light switch and you get a static shock reaching back for you, you've got it too low. So you need to keep it somewhere in between the two. The house itself would rather be on the dry side. Anytime we get a lot of excess moisture in the house, we end up with the chances of condensation and mold, mildew, and things like that. So I would try and keep it as dry as comfortable in the house. But like I say, if you're walking across the carpet, you get a static charge. You go to pet the cat and the blue arc goes to his nose and the hair stands up and the cat runs away for 3 days. It probably needs a little bit more moisture in the house. If it's a relatively tight house, sometimes you can get away with just not turning the fan on when taking a shower to put extra moisture in the house. But if it's an older house with a lot of air leakage and older windows, then a humidifier of some sort is not a bad idea. You just have to remember you need to adjust it according to how cold it is outdoors. So if you've got 0 degree days, you don't need much moisture in the house to be relatively high. If it's 30 degrees outside, you may need a little bit more moisture. And once it gets over about 40 degrees here in Illinois or even in Terre Haute, then we usually have enough moisture that we probably don't need the humidifier running.
Yeah. If you take the standard sensor and regulator that come with these powered humidifiers, they don't cost very much. But if you ask them to provide a regulator with a sensor outside and a sensor inside and to really do a good job of regulation, the price goes up by maybe $350, actually. And I'm wondering if one needs the extra $350 regulator.
It depends if you're trying to make the unit completely automatic to where you don't have to do anything. My rule of thumb is if you had to use one, to use it on the days when it's dry and then turn it down whenever possible, especially when it starts warming up. And just, like I say, regulate it yourself without the unit. You don't need an outdoor temperature or an outdoor humidistat to realize that, hey, it's 30 degrees and raining outside. I probably don't need to add more moisture in the house. So my guess is the only time you'll really need to add more moisture to the house is when we have days that are under about 20 degrees. Because when it's above 20 degrees in this area, usually there's enough humidity outdoors that the house doesn't dry out that much.
As you get older, you tend to need a little more humidity or slap on a lot more lotion.
They did some studies at one point in time, and I can't recall who it was. The gist of it was that if they had a room that had a high humidity level in it, that was, a given temperature, a warm temperature, people felt comfortable when they first walked into it. But if they were in the room for more than a couple hours, then the higher humidity room was not as comfortable as a room that was drier and not necessarily as warm, perceived comfort levels. I have to see if I can look that one up and see if I can find that one again. But, yeah, with your power humidifier, I would have to recommend you probably don't need the outdoor unit, but definitely keep an eye on it. And if you've got water on the windows, you've got to get it turned down or turned off.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Thanks for the call. We have some other folks here, and our next would be in on line number 3, I believe, right here. Hello.
Is it my turn?
Yes, go ahead.
I have in my walls, in my dining room and living room, cracks in the plaster, and the cracks are kind of in all directions where there's a multiple number of cracks, and they're probably anywhere from 4 to 8 inches area in the diameter, and they're a foot up. Most of them are about a foot up from the floor on the plaster is sand plaster finish. And I think I could just, stick my finger in there and pull it all off, but I don't want to do that. How can I repair that? Because there isn't any way to clamp it. And mm-hmm. What do I use to repair it? Is there some kind of glue I can get in there?
No, generally when you start getting loose or flaking plaster, as it plaster, of course, hasn't been used in probably 60 years in this area, so
that's
therefore,
how old the house is.
And so it's kind of hard to find somebody to do repair work. As plaster ages, it does get more brittle, so that movement in the house, just the normal expansion contraction of the wood framing from humidity changes and temperature changes, you can get some cracking. Occasionally, it's an indication that we've got some other problem, either sill plate shift from, termite damage, moisture damage, things like that. So it's one of those things where
I was wondering if it had anything to do with that earthquake we had a few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago.
I will have to say that that's a possibility. It's not as likely. Usually when the house shakes, everything will tend to move together. so you don't get as much plaster cracking as you'd think until we get some really significant earthquakes. And then, of course, we start losing all sorts of structural issues as well. Anything masonry or solid that doesn't give will tend to crack. So yeah, I won't say it's not impossible, but it's probably not likely. My guess is we just have a little bit of wood shrinkage or expansion from temperature and humidity changes, and the plaster did not flex with the wood framing of the house and cause a crack. There's no good repair for the plaster once it's cracked, short of removing any of the loose plaster and reapplying a plaster coat. And unfortunately, a lot of times the repair looks worse than the cracks because, again, it's very difficult to find somebody that's good with plaster. There are a few people out there, and you'll have to shop around and see if you can find somebody that is good with plaster, and I would ask for some recommendations that maybe you could call some other.
Do you know people that could do that?
Do not have a plaster person at this point in time.
Oh.
I think the last one that I was recommending ended up retiring and moving away. So I don't, at the moment, don't have somebody that I could recommend.
The thing is that if you repair it, then you've got to paint. And it's never going to match, so that means you paint everything.
Yep, that is correct. That's why I say sometimes it's easier to live with the crack than it is to worry about it. The crack is 99% chance that the crack is strictly a cosmetic issue and not necessarily anything significant. But obviously without seeing it, I can't guarantee that.
Yeah, it's funny that there, so many of them are just like a foot off from the floor.
Yeah, without seeing it and knowing what the actual situation, I'm not sure I could comment too much on that. But most likely, they're not an indication of a structural problem.
Well, can cold? I have in the corner in the south in the southwest corner of the dining room. There's a crack all the way up the seam, and then some about shoulder high laterally. That looks strange to me. Is that because of, is that a very cold corner there?
The temperature and humidity level of the house, since the house is wood framing, does affect, I'll call the growth of the house. As the house warms up and gets humid in the summertime, the wood tends to pick up some moisture and the house will actually increase in size, fractions of an inch, obviously. And then when you have good cold winter weather that really dries things out, then the house can shrink. So there is some movement, and depending on how the framing is and how the foundation walls zig and zag in the basement, there can be some differential in movement that will cause cracking like that. But like I said, most.
Is there any way you can screw it back in place?
Generally, no. Once it's cracked, it means it has lost its bond, and once to the wall covering, whatever the rock lath or the metal lath is behind it. And there's really not much way of reattaching it short of taking it off.
Okay. Well, I'm disappointed, but
all right.
Well, thank you anyway.
Thanks for the call. We're at our midpoint here. This is our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies is with us from the Spies Home Inspection Service. And if you have some kind of problem and you're not quite sure how to deal with it, give us a call. Describe it, and Scott will see what he can do to help you out. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. On again to another call. This is line number one. Hello.
Scott, how you doing?
Yeah.
Hi, David.
Hey.
I'm kind of want to shift the subject to something that we should be thinking about here as soon as it becomes nice and warm enough to go ahead and start putting a new roof on. And one of the things I'd like to do is, while we're in the process of putting a new roof on, we weren't going to tear off, we're just going to put another layer. That would be layer number two over some asphalt shingles. But I want to, we have soffit attic vents, but I want to complement that by either adding 12-inch turbine exhaust vents or using some solar-powered attic wind vents. And I'd like your opinion as to how many of these I should have to maximally replace all the hot air inside the attic when the summertime comes, because we're going to have this rare opportunity to install these attic vents in a roof that doesn't have any. Well, they've got some small passive ones, but I want to be able to exchange a lot of air. so that when summertime comes, we can remove as much of that thermal mass as possible. The roof faces east and faces west, and it's a normal champagne tract subdivision that has, I don't know what kind of a pitched roof you would call it, a 612?
Okay. Actually, generally, I don't worry too much about powered or mechanical venting. The passive works quite well. As long as you've got open soffit vents in the soffit area or the lower portion of the attic, mm-hmm. and you have some type of opening at the top, when you start building up heat, natural convection will cause hot air to rise. Mm-hmm. And when the hot air rises up out through the upper vents, it will draw air in from the lower vents to replace that. So you do get a natural convection through the attic. Generally, we don't need the mechanical venting unless we've got a roof that has a hip roof, a steep hip roof where we haven't got room to put multiple vents, and we've got a limited area where we can ventilate the top of the attic. On a conventional gable type roof, a ridge vent works very well. Multiple button vents or the little round vents on the back side of the house work quite well. The key is to make sure that your soffit ventilation is open and the insulation is not up against the roof sheathing blocking that soffit ventilation. They make a product called an air chute, which is a styrofoam wedge that you put out towards the soffit area
right.
to hold the insulation back to keep this air moving.
Those are in place up
okay.
And extend into the soffit. Whether or not they have clear access to the vents that were put in the soffit, of course, remains to be seen. Because we're putting the roof in, we get, I guess you could say, for the next 25 years, we get one shot to increase the air circulation here without having to tear into a perfectly good new roof. So
mm-hmm.
I want to get it right. The roof, like I said, faces east and faces west, and it gets the largest amount of its exposure to sun facing west just because of the layout of the neighborhood and the trees in the summertime. And I want to be able to remove as much of that hot air or get it to recirculate as possible or continually circulate even after the sun has gone down to go ahead and pull as much cool air above the second floor as it can.
Well, like I say, Mother Nature pretty much does that with convection for us. As the attic heats up, as long as the attic is warmer than the outside air, that hot air will want to rise up to the peak. That's one of the reasons why most of the new construction, you'll see a ridge vent system where they just cut an inch and a half or 2-inch gap at the very peak of the roof for
uh-huh.
the entire length, and then put a cap over the top of it, which helps reduce the chances of wind or blowing any snow or rain down through it. And that way, when the hot air gets to the top, it goes out, and as air leaves the house, it has to draw air in from the soffit. It's amazing how, with the ridge vent installed, I can go into attics on hot, bright, sunny days, you know, 100 degrees outside, and the attic temperature is above 100 degrees, but it's not soaring because we are getting, as the attic gets warmer, we do get more airflow. Unless you've got a restricted style of roofing, most of the time a soffit vent combined with a ridge vent is about all you will need in this area. Now, as far as heat in the attic, as long as you've got probably a good 10 to 12 inches of insulation in the attic, that heat really is not affecting the house as much as you'd think it is. Hot air, again, does tend to rise and doesn't radiate downward as much. So as long as you've got a reasonable amount of insulation in the attic, you're probably not getting a heating effect on the ceilings. And obviously, if you've only got about 3.5 inches of insulation, yes, a warm attic can create an air conditioning problem. But that's corrected more with insulation than with ventilation.
Would you say that might be definitely what's happening here? A house that's built in the late 70s, it's a two-story house. We've just upgraded our air conditioning because it seemed to be failing. But in trying to watch our energy expenses, we can come home in the afternoon, 5 o'clock. Downstairs will be, say, in the low 70s or in the high 70s. But if you go upstairs, it will be 85 or so.
Okay.
It's tough to try and make that go away by the time we get ready to go to bed at 9:30 or 10.
Are you turning the air conditioner off during the day when you're not there?
Or turning it down, yeah.
How far?
Well, I'm guessing if it's I try to keep it running at around 73, 74, but I'm not averse, and maybe I'm letting too much hot air creep back in, say, when people aren't in the house, to run it up to, say, 80.
I generally, with an air conditioner, don't recommend a swing of more than about 4 or 5 degrees. The reason being is generally an air conditioner in this area is not as much of a cooling device as it is a dehumidification device. If you turn the air conditioner off for too long and let a lot of humidity back in the house, the air conditioner can run and cool the house back down to the temperature, but it does not feel comfortable because it hasn't run long enough to take the moisture or the humidity back out of the house.
For the vicinity, what would you recommend then to save energy?
The key thing is, it actually sounds to me like what we might need to do is work a little bit on the balancing of your heating and cooling system. If the cooling system is putting the cold air in on the first floor, then yes, the second floor is not going to cool down. Usually they can install, or sometimes even have already done so, duct dampers, which allow you to balance how much air goes upstairs versus downstairs. And in the summertime, we put almost all of our air up on the second floor and let that cool air fall down to the first floor. And in the wintertime, we put almost all of our air on the first floor and let it rise up.
Yeah.
Yes. So if you've got it.
I will intentionally do that. And whether or not it's perfectly balanced, of course, is, can only be achieved with a gauge to monitor what it will take for a residence. But I am doing that rather religiously. But maybe the house just, I don't know, isn't that efficient.
Actually, as a
new commercial building or something.
Well, one of the things, and I have seen it happen where when a builder built the house, that a couple of places got missed for insulation, or there were some gaps that have a lot of air leakage. This time of year, there are a couple companies locally that can do energy audits that have like a FLIR gun or a temperature gun that can actually find. Usually, they work better in cold weather. It will find where there's the lack of insulation. It will show up as a nice blue spot on their screen, and then any place where it's warm will turn more of a reddish orange. So I do know that that is available, to where we could do a quick look on the house and see, okay, is there anything inherently wrong with the house that might be creating this problem? How much insulation you've got in the attic is going to make a difference. I would say you need a minimum these days of 10 to 12. I think on new construction we're requiring an R55 at this point in time, which is about 14 inches insulation, 14, 15 inches insulation.
In bats?
Either loose fill or bat. It's quite often it's less expensive to install the loose fill or have someone install the loose fill than it would be to install bats on your own. The bats do have a problem of air gaps. You can't always get them butted up tightly together at all at surfaces, so you end up with spaces in the insulation where air can get down through there. And if you've got a bat-type insulation in the attic at the moment, putting a few inches of loose insulation over the top of it actually will increase its efficiency, because it will fill in any of the low spots or any of the air gaps and help reduce any convection through there.
All right. I'm just looking, you know, we're going to have to invest this summer. We're just whistling in the wind. Our roof has lasted quite a while. It's definitely worn out.
Yep,
and you may not even be in the roofing business. You can tell that, my God, you don't have any leaks, but it's time to go.
Yep, and the ridge vent with the soffit vent is a very good way in our climate to get the ventilation in the attic that we need.
Right. I hope the caller will forgive me if I jump in here. We have some other folks who want to get on to, and we have about 20 minutes or so, a little bit less, in this hour of Focus 580. We're taking questions on home maintenance. This is something that we do every month on the show. It's always a Monday. And the guest is Scott Spies. He's an inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. Now, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up, we have someone here on our line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a purely academic question. You treated fireplaces earlier. I have a friend who has a Franklin-type, rather decorative freestanding fireplace. And I was wondering what the efficiency of these are. Not that I'd want to be dragging wood into my house.
Mm-hmm. Well, there again, some of them are more efficient than others. You do have to remember that when the wood is done burning, that we have to leave a flue open. And when that flue is open, let's say we've got an 8-inch diameter flue. Well, if you happen to have an 8-inch diameter hole in the front door, you'd probably want to cover it pretty quickly. Unfortunately, you can't with a fireplace. We have to let those embers die out. So any air that we heated does tend to go up and out. So unless you're burning the fireplace more than, say, 15 or 18 hours a day, it probably is losing as much heat as it's producing. It does do a nice job of taking a chill off a room because it does give you a radiant heat and gives you a nice warm fuzzy feeling when you stand near it. But overall, by the time most people will have it late in the evening. Late in the evening, and then when they go to bed, they close up the fireplace. But that flue is still open, so all night long, all the warm air is going up and out through the flue. So in the morning, it's going to be actually cooler in the house, or the furnace had to work harder to bring it back up. So they're good for running a temperature up for a short period of time or for some ambiance and things like that. But as far as a general heating source, unless you run that fireplace on a regular basis, literally mean 16, 18 hours a day or more, chances are it is losing more heat than it's actually producing.
So what you said about the conventional fireplace applies to the freestanding Franklin type?
Well, the wood stoves are a little better in that once we're done, we can close them up. We don't have as much air loss going up and out through the flue. There is still an opening, and those things don't usually have sealed combustion chambers. If they did... you'd have to have some type of fan or air supply to them. I have seen the pellet stoves and things like that, which the efficiency rating does come way up. However, they're not what I'd call a casual heating unit. They're usually more for somebody that's trying to heat a specific area, and that is the only heat or the primary heat source. The biggest problem I run into with most Franklin stoves, and it actually isn't much to do with heat loss, and that is installation. People don't get a large enough hearth around it to prevent any heat damage to the wood. We don't have proper clearances to walls for the flues. Generally speaking, a freestanding fireplace, I believe the recommendation is it's supposed to be a minimum of 27 inches from the nearest combustible material, which means unless you put it out in the middle of the room, it is probably too close to something that's flammable. And most of the time they are a decorative unit, and so people try and get them as far back into a corner so that they're not the primary accent on the room. So most of the time on the freestanding units, what I find is that they're not installed well enough to be used at 15 or 18 hours a day because it would overheat the framing and such around it. But I can't say that it doesn't help, but it's not efficient. Even with the closed up doors and chambers, you're probably still no more than about 25 or 30% efficient as far as how much heat it puts in the house versus how much goes up the flue after you turn it off, unless you're using it as a major source for most of the day.
Well, thank you.
All right, and again to another caller here, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Can you offer me any guidance on reducing the amount of dust in my room, in my house? I've lived here for about 3.5 years, and it seems to me that this house is particularly dusty. Even in the winter, I have to dust every week, and by the time the end of that week rolls around, I can run my fingers across a piece of furniture, and it billows up.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, a high dust content would mean that we have a lot of air leakage. Again, air getting around windows or window casings, doors, things like that. So some sealing of the house would be helpful. I would check your furnace filter. I'm assuming we're running a forced air induction system since we are in this area.
I am not. It's all electric.
But is it a radiant type heat?
Yeah. Radiators in every room.
Okay, so basically we do not have any place where we can put a filter to filter the air as it's being blown through. So,
well, correct. There is an air conditioning system that uses ductwork.
Okay, well, the air conditioner, what I would do is make sure the air conditioner has a really good filter on it. And actually, you could run the fan on the air conditioner unit without having the air conditioner run. Usually, they'll have an on switch where we just blow the fan and we can draw air through and put in one of the good pleated filters and take out a lot of the dust in the house. But my guess is, we've got some air leakage around windows or window framing to where that outside air is blowing in through the house. Are you in an area where they're doing a lot of new construction or anything, or a rural area?
No, I'm not.
Huh. Usually new construction, of course, because of the amount of dust they put in doing houses, that the first few years it's easy to get a lot of dust in the house. Or a rural area where we've got the farmers running up and down the fields, we can get a lot of dust in the house. But basically, if you're getting that dust, my guess is we've got some air leakage issues around the openings in the house that are letting some of that dust in. And without having an air system to filter it, I don't have a good way of telling you to remove it. So I'm going to have to say I can't help.
Oh, okay. Well, and as far as the air conditioner fan, I would run that just to clear the air?
You could, if you've got dust in the air, that yes, you could put in a fairly high-efficiency pleated-type filter and just turn the fan to the on position and just let it run. Most of the time, an air conditioner fan has a multiple speed setting. For air conditioning, they like to set it up a little bit higher. For heating, you'd set it down a little bit lower. You'd have to check with your serviceman to see if what setting it's on when you put it in the fan-only position, what fan speed is set. If you're going to run it in the wintertime, then you may want to have that setting reduced so that it's not moving high volumes of air, just making sure that it's moving some air and drawing the air in the house through the filter and filtering out the dust.
I see. So what that fan does is blow air from the inside?
On an air conditioner, you've got a return air grill somewhere, and it pulls the air from inside the house, blows it across a cooling coil, and then out through the ductwork. And so by just turning it on, you are drawing the air in the house through that filtering system to help take that dust out.
Okay. Then I've got to work harder to heat the house.
Well, the air conditioner should not be on at that point in time. So all you're doing is circulating air through the house. You're not adding heat or taking heat away. So it's the only disadvantage is if you get a room where you get the air moving fast enough where it feels like a draft, then yes, you're going to feel less comfortable in the house. The temperature of the room is not going to change, but it is going to feel drafty. No, it's not going to pull any heat out. All you're doing is pulling air in the return and blowing it back out through the supply duct. So we're not taking any heat anywhere.
Okay. And where would the filter be?
The filter should be on the intake side or the return air side of the air conditioner coil.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's on a unit outside.
You've got a window-type air conditioner?
No.
Okay. Central. We're not going to use the unit outdoors if you're just turning the fan on. That unit does not run if you have just the fan. An air conditioner has two parts. It has an outdoor compressor unit, and then it has an indoor air handler. And the air handler is strictly a fan with the A coil in it, and usually the filter is there or the filter is in one of the return air ducts. If you just turn the fan system on, it will circulate air through the house, pulling the air through the filter and then blowing it back out through the supply ducts. As long as it's in the fan-only position, the outdoor compressor will not start up, so therefore you're not pulling any heat out and you're not running any air outdoors.
I see. Okay, and where would that fan, filter be then?
Well, what I would do is find the air handler, which is usually looks sort of like a furnace, and the filter is on the intake side or the return air side. I don't know where your air conditioner is located. It could be in an attic. It could be in a crawl space. It could be in a closet somewhere.
Okay. So, all right, but it would be inside.
Yes, your air handling unit is in the house.
Okay.
Quite often, if it's an electric house, they'll throw one up in the attic area, so your filter would be up in the attic.
Okay.
And if you've never changed it, when it comes time to do your air conditioning, you'll get much better performance from your air conditioner if you have a clean filter in there.
Yeah. There you go, David. Thank you.
Thank you both.
All right. We have about 5, 6, 7 minutes left in this part of Focus. Pardon me for jumping in there.
Oh, no, that was...
And Scott Spies is here. He's with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's been here for quite a while, several years now. We've been doing the show. Actually, with one Spies or another, we've been doing the show for a long time. Once a month, we talk about home maintenance. And if you have a question, you pick up the telephone and call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. And probably... it's a good idea to change your filter, particularly if you have forced air heat and it's running all the time. Probably it's good to at least look at it once a month to see what it looks like?
Generally speaking, unless you've got long hair pets, you can probably get by with changing it about every 2 to 3 months. Again, depends on how much hair is in the air from the cats and the dogs, or how much dust you've got in the house, or how many people are in the house. But yeah, the efficiency of the furnace or air conditioner is dependent upon airflow. So if you get a filter that starts to block up, starts to get dirty, we are reducing the amount of air through the system. Therefore, we're reducing the efficiency of the system because it can no longer transfer as much heat one way or the other. And so a clean filter does improve the performance of your entire heating or cooling system.
Yeah, so whichever you're talking about, heating or cooling, if the air is not moving through there the way it should, you're not going to get the level of performance, whatever it's capable of, whatever its efficiency is, you're not going to get it if the filter's all
blocked
up.
Or if you've closed down too many of the dampers on the registers. Yeah. I've seen people close off all the rooms in the house except one or two to try and save energy, and you're actually reducing the efficiency of your furnace and probably not helping your energy bill much because the furnace is no longer able to move enough air to work properly, so the furnace ends up overheating. Because we're not cooling the heat exchanger down, because we've got it blocked down or restricted as to how much air we can move through it.
Okay. And again, we have some other callers here, and we'll try to get in everybody. And next is Champagne. This will be line one. Hello.
I remember your dad saying he never opened his windows in the summer. For those
how many times have we heard that speech? Yes.
You know, I've tried that, but I just kind of like the fresh air. So, yeah, we have to do it. But my question has to do with external things. Like, I've heard for some people with brick houses, they have to do what they call tuck pointing. Is that something you do as a maintenance, you know, yearly basis, or only every few years?
Okay, tuck pointing is actually a mortar repair. If you're getting cracking in the mortar to where the mortar is falling out or the bricks are getting loose, the tuck point is an actual mortar repair.
That's a major kind of repair.
It's not something that you would do as a maintenance because hopefully the mortar never cracks and falls out of the brick.
Okay.
About the only thing we do with brick is look at it and do not paint it.
I've seen that they're around, so don't do that.
Painting a brick will take what I'll call a low maintenance material and make it into a high maintenance material.
If you
paint the brick, what happens is it seals any moisture in the brick from the outside, and we end up with condensation or moisture problems in the house. We can end up with moisture in the brick, and the moisture can't get out because the paint creates a barrier, and we end up with what's known as spalling, where the moisture in the brick freezes, expands, and actually breaks the face of the brick off. Almost every painted house you'll see will have one or two red bricks here or there, even though they're painted. Well, that tells me that they're actually damaging the brick by putting the paint on it.
Masonry,
unless it's showing some signs of some loose mortar, bricks coming loose, cracks in corners, things like that, no, you don't need to do any real maintenance to it.
Okay, great. Well, how about maintenance on concrete now that we've got all this salt that we're using so much? Is there a good product that just, you know, for like pot little holes and other kinds of cracks and stuff like that are appearing on the driveway these days? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, if small cracks, they do make some liquid crack fillers that you can put in there, which will help reduce the amount of water that'll get down in through there. And again, water getting into the concrete and then freezing will tend to lift it and create more cracks. If you start getting spalling or the surface peeling up, they do make some top coatings, but they're more of a temporary type fix. Most of them don't bond real well, so they end up coming loose again a few years later. So there's no good way to fix spalling on a permanent level short of putting another layer of concrete on over the top of it. But cracks themselves, they do make, and it's a liquid self-leveling sealer. If it's a large crack, they make a foam backer rod. You say you've got a half-inch crack, you can get a half-inch foam rod that you can put down in there and drop it down all quarter of an inch or so deep, and that way when you put your crack filler over the top of it, you don't have to fill all the way to Timbuktu down to the bottom of the driveway. So you can just get a seal on the surface. In this area, I don't do too much or don't recommend too much in the way of sealing concrete exterior because half the moisture that comes in does come in from the bottom as well as the top because we've always got the damp soil. So there's not much to do with the concrete other than try and keep the garbage truck off of it. Most of our driveways in this area are poured to about a 4-inch depth, and large moving trucks, garbage trucks, things like that are heavier than what 4 inches of concrete is designed for. So after somebody has done some major remodeling and we've had large construction equipment, all of a sudden their driveway starts coming apart the next year or two. So try and keep the extra heavy-duty vehicles off of your driveway, and that will help concrete last longer.
Let's see. Vincennes, Indiana, next. Line 4. Yeah, hello.
Hi. I have an old house built in the 20s, and I have a bathroom with the plaster walls are really in bad shape. I need to take the plaster and the wood lath back to the studs and start over. And my question is, what is your recommendation on how to do that? In particular, I want to keep the dust to a minimum.
That's going to be tricky. They do make some really neat drop cloth systems where you can actually adhere a plastic across the doorway, and then they make a tape-on zipper. You put this tape onto the plastic, and then when you unzip it, it cuts the plastic, and then you can zip and unzip the plastic door so that you can go in and out of the room and not necessarily have to leave the door open and get the dust through the house. Huh. But be quite honest, taking out plaster lath is going to make a mess.
Okay, I guess I could ask you one more follow-up question here. What's the latest and greatest on insulation from the inside? Do I spray it first to get all the cracks and stuff taken care of and then put the bat in?
Usually, if you put the bat insulation into the wall and then put a vapor barrier or a sheet of plastic on the inside, you probably don't need to do the sealing of the cracks.
Okay.
That should seal it up pretty well. And again, if you're using a bathroom any place around a shower surround, you should use a green board rather than a standard drywall so it's a little more water resistant.
Right. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll try to get one more. And at Champagne, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm remodeling the kitchens and got to the point now where we have drywall and it's been primed and painted. And we want to put a backsplash, a little ceramic tile up.
Uh-huh.
What else do we put on the drywall?
Usually, if it's been primed and painted, that they can usually go right over the top of that. Sometimes they'll put a backer board that has a little less expansion contraction than the drywall. I'm going to have to say that is probably not my area of expertise, and I would go to one of the tile contractors and find out what they do recommend. Tiling is one thing that I haven't done, so I'm. I hate to admit it, but I don't know everything. generally speaking, the tile will go over the top of drywall. I know if we put it on floors, we have to use a concrete backer board. They do make some thin backer boards, which will be less prone to a movement. The problem with ceramic tile is it does not flex, so that if the wall moves behind it, you can get cracks. So usually they try and put something very solid behind the tile so that we don't get any movement or cracks in the grout.
Okay, great.
But yeah, I'm going to defer that to a tile specialist.
Okay, I'll go find one.
Well, thanks very much.
Bye.
Well, there we'll have to finish up for this time around with our thanks to Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's with us once a month to do the show on home maintenance, and we'll do it again next month. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, David, for having me, and thanks for everybody for calling in.
AM 580 also thanks Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. We don't have market reports today. Markets are closed, so just a moment here, we'll go to National Public Radio for news, and we'll be back here with more of Focus 580. Coming up in the next part of the show, we'll have some of our management team in the studio with us to talk about some recent changes, and they're pretty significant that we've announced here both in our programming and our staff.